Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hello and welcome to Finding Annie. We are very near the end of this series. This is the penultimate episode and it's a great one. Surprise, surprise. Massive reactions to Dr. Rupi last week and our episode all about eating animals. Thank you so much for getting in touch about that. Just going to read out one little bit of an email from Joanne Smith, who says, I'm 43. I've eaten meat all my life, as well as having pets growing up. It wasn't until 4 years ago I really started to think about the mass production of meat and the treatment of animals that comes with that. All of what you discussed around what society deems acceptable to have as a pet and what is acceptable to eat really resonated with me. I remember being young and loving seeing lambs, but lamb was one of my favourite meats to eat. The part of the conversation about being disconnected from where food comes from was so spot on. The reason why I decided to give up eating meat was because I inherited a pet rat. I rat sat for 5 days and went from what could be described as a common attitude when presented with a rat to falling hard for this rat. Looking after the pet rat made me realise, as you touched upon with the pig, that all animals, no matter how much of a bad rep they might have or however misunderstood, are intelligent, emotional and sentient creatures, and to expose any of them to brutality for our consumption is pretty sickening. So that's just one bit of a very, very long email. But I like the idea of her coming round to animals after rat sitting. It's a whole new thing. Yeah, but thank you to everyone for that. I hope that the conversation felt balanced and not all judgy and preachy. And I hope that it helped you or just made you think in some way or shape or form. That was the whole point. This week's episode is called La Comédienne. It's about women who make us laugh. And to start it off, as always, I would like to hand over to a memory. And this is one of my oldest and best friends from the Black Country, as you will recognise from her accent, Reju. Take it away.
Well, the thing is, I mean, I've known you for ages and I think you're really funny. But, you know, there's always that one joke that you tell. And it's always when you get so excited that you've spotted a new person who hasn't heard this joke. There's a new audience. And, you know, it's usually been when we're out, when we're all really chatty, and then somebody says something funny, and you're like, oh my God, have you heard this joke? Let me tell you a joke. And then you tell it. And most of the time people do actually laugh, maybe in support of you. But it's 2020, babe. It's come in. I think you need some new jokes. I'll get you a joke book for Christmas.
I've got to tell the joke now, don't I? You're going to want to hear this joke. Normally I'm drunk when I do this, but she is right. I roll it out every time. It's the one joke that I have in my repertoire. Okay, you ready? Here goes. Whew. What do you call an apartment block covered in tiny little vaginas? Ready? A block of flaps. Yep. And that is why I have never pursued a career in comedy. This episode is, however, about women who do pursue careers in comedy. You can sing it to the tune of Roy Orbison's Pretty Woman if you like. Funny women, woo, walking down the street. Funny women, the kind you like to meet. Funny women. There's been two instances really that stand out when it comes to funny women, professional funny women, female comedians. The first is a woman called Kelly Backman, who's an American comedian who's been a victim of sexual abuse and brought her experiences into her work by putting together this show, a comedy show called Rape Jokes by Survivors. So she said she was so sick of hearing rape jokes from people who hadn't been raped. And she thought it would be a very healing and kind of positive thing to kind of find a group of people who had been raped, which in this case was all women, and get them to come on stage and tell jokes about their kind of experiences of this horrible thing. And she said it was the most healing and wonderful thing. And she's never been in a room like it with such kind of support and solidarity. So that's besides the point, but that's a little backstory on her. She was doing a stand-up show in New York back at the end of October called Actors Hour, which is just like a rolling show where loads of comedians come on and do their thing. And Harvey Weinstein was in the audience. He is currently out and living normally because he posted $1 million of bail. So he's kind of awaiting his trials. And he's had some public appearances, and that was one. So he was in the audience. She knew he was in the audience, and she couldn't not refer to it. So she basically said that her job as the comic is to have to kind of declare the elephant in the room. But in this case, she said it was a Freddy Krueger in the room. She went on to talk about how she wasn't expecting to have to bring her mace to Actors Hour. She got a lot of heckling at the time, but she said the next morning she woke up and there was a huge amount of support and solidarity and requests for media appearances off the back of it. And it felt like a kind of shift of power in the room. She said she had to do it. She couldn't not call him out. Out of respect for the group of people she worked with in her show Rape Jokes by Survivors. The second instance, most recently, that is of note, is a woman called Courtney Pong, who was hosting a comedy night at the Rosie Square Theatre in Boston recently, and basically midway through the evening decided to shut down the night. Stop it. She came to the stage, said, I don't want to keep doing this. Everyone in the audience can have a refund. This is not what this theatre is supposed to convey. This is not the content we want in this room. She said the audience were basically kind of hit with a barrage of persistent racist and sexist jokes. And she said it wasn't about making a judgment call on whether these jokes were funny. It was more just a basic point that, and I quote her here when I say this, no woman in the world would have felt safe in that room, unquote. It does feel like there is a shift happening in comedy. Like so many things in the arts, it is difficult for women and people of colour to break into the industry, let alone the transgender community. I mean, that's a whole other ball game. The stats are predictably depressing and unsurprising. Like I said, it's the same in every section of the arts, from the music industry to the TV and film industry to the art industry. It's all skewed towards men because that's the way it's always been. It's a vicious circle. You can't compete with men who have more writing credits or more experience on the comedy stages or places in panel shows. You can't find a producer who understands your voice. They say that there's no audience for it because it's never been done before, so no one's ever had a chance to prove it. You're the lone female in a writer's room, so it's doubly hard to thrive. You have to be twice as clever, twice as quick, twice as hard, twice as confident. All these things that make it super intimidating and tough for women to kind of break through and be successful in the world of comedy. Things are changing more and more rapidly. You know, we have amazing women breaking through the world of TV sitcoms. Sharon Horgan, who's been on this podcast previously, a total trailblazer. Her protege, Aisling Bia, smashing it. Phoebe Waller-Bridge, now so big time, writing for James Bond. Imagine a woman writing for James Bond. Like, what's it going to sound like? What's it going to feel like? Also, something that happened this year of note is a woman called Saskia Schuster. She sounds like a badass villain in a James Bond film, but she's not. She's actually very high up at ITV. And she is a commissioner for some of the biggest entertainment shows on ITV. And she no longer commissions anything with an all-male writing team. So, obviously, it's taking a woman at the top to make this decision and to see that there is a problem in the first place. And like all of the arts industries, we need more women in the boardrooms to empower women to thrive at their respective companies. And that's beyond art. That's just the world of business, full stop. It's a long fucking slog. But I would like to use this episode and this whole week to celebrate the funny women and the women who are sassy and sharp and who kind of bring their pain and their emotions into their work in the most brilliant way. To help me do that, I would like to introduce to you a lady called Alice Levine. So Alice is my colleague at BBC Radio 1, but she's way more than her radio career. She is a TV presenter. She's done all sorts of TV. She's most recently did a documentary called Living with the Far Right. So that kind of gives you a view of how kind of far she can go in terms of the content that she works with. She is a documentarian, she is a writer, she is a radio presenter, and most kind of famously recently, she is one third of one of the biggest podcasts in the world, which is called My Dad Wrote a Porno. You probably are aware of it. If you aren't, it's about a bloke who is Alice's friend in real life, whose father decided to write a porno. And it's Alice and her two friends sitting, kind of reading the porno out loud and just laughing at it in a very funny and sharp way. It's side-splittingly funny, this, and it's kind of very addictive because you get hooked into the narrative. It's clever in so many ways, which is pretty much Alice Levine, actually. Clever in so many ways. Also tremendously humble, as you will hear in this conversation. But yeah, I was so happy to get a chance to sit down with her, and we talked about all sorts of things, from her being a guest on panel shows to her favourite comedians, to how to write, to getting the impetus and the confidence to write. And then at the end, I feel like I really bullied her into writing a sitcom. I feel a bit bad about that one. Anyway, let's begin. Enter the podcast, Alice Levine. We are here in a very fancy meeting room in central London. Outside is a not very fancy building site with some sporadic drilling.
Chainsaw.
Alice Levine, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thank you so much.
I arranged it especially for you.
This... I feel right at home. This is wonderful. Thanks.
Okay, so you are here.
Just a false pretense.
In case you didn't know, right?
You said, do you want to have lunch? And now, and now you're here.
Well, you're busy. You always slag me off for being busy. You are one busy lady, babe.
Don't give me that. I once heard that Jamie Oliver divides his time into 15-minute segments. That's how you book him. You're worse than that. You're like 7.5 minutes. And maybe, I don't know, half of that is scheduling the next meet. Yeah, you're phenomenal.
Can we tell the story of the ponds? Because it's one of my favourite stories ever.
So our mutual friend Kate is a Highgate, or Hampstead Ponds, Ladies Ponds advocate.
Still going, by
evangelist.
The way.
Still going. It's five degrees there now. Yeah. And so she said, oh, well, Annie really wants to go and you like going there. Let's all go on a girl's date and go swimming there. Obviously, you were sort of a day and a half early and
no,
I was about a day and a half late.
On time. On time.
My punctuality is terrible. I hold my hands up. It's awful.
Kate was like, oh, don't worry, Alice is always late. I'm like, oh, well, what's the edit? Do we wait for her? Because I'm not very good at waiting. So we got in.
You got in. So then by the time that I got in, you were over it.
I'm a shit swimmer. Yeah. So I was kind of like really weak. So I was kind of like proper huffing and puffing. And I was holding on to a life buoy, right? Which is what I like to do for my little rests around the lake. And you arrived, kind of floated in. And I was really happy to see you. So I kind of waved at you from the life buoy. So I had one arm on the life buoy, like huffing and puffing, red face, and one arm waving. And the lifeguard was like, are you okay? And I was like, yes, I'm fine. I'm just saying hello to my friend.
Because they're quite officious. They're extremely effective, but they're kind of, I mean, I didn't go to this kind of school, but I imagine what the PE teachers at a girls' school would be like. They're quite strict, but you want their respect and their adoration. And she said, she told you that that was the international sign for distress. And we were like, but it's also the international sign for hi, how are you? So you could see where we went wrong.
I basically got reprimanded in front of the entire lake.
Yeah.
And all the swimmers felt like such an idiot.
We were all laughing at you, yeah.
And then you came in and then we had one swift lap.
We did. And then you went, I'm going to float for 2 minutes. And we were like, okay. Annie Mack scheduling a float. And then you were gone. But that was the thing,
then
you were gone.
Went,
So I...
Well, then it's like, how long do I... I don't know how long you're going to be. I don't want to rush
clothes.
You.
I didn't know if your clothes were sort of full Monty style Velcroed, but your clothes were on within seconds. And then you waved and then you were gone. And our friend Kate was like, yeah, she'll be on to the next meeting. She's probably got a Heath meetup, but meters away. I was like, sure. I know, I fully respected it. I was just like, I wish I had that kind of efficiency.
So
So listen, I want to talk to you about comedy in general. Who is the first woman that you remember seeing and laughing your head off at?
Probably Jennifer Saunders. French and Saunders were, yeah, a big one. And also because they just seem to be having such a good time. And I think that that's what I'm really drawn to, is when people... When people are on, kind of on the brink of corpsing, or you feel like what they're doing for their act is sort of just inches away from what they would be doing even if they weren't performing for other people. You know, that kind of thing of like you're getting an insight into what they would just do with their mates.
Yeah.
So yeah, I do. Jennifer Saunders definitely made me howl. And then later on, Julia Davis is just a massive comedy pinup. But I kind of, when you asked me to do this, I was a bit worried because you were like, oh, talk about funny women. And I was like, yeah, but I kind of feel bad claiming that I'm a comedian or that I work in comedy.
You're being a woman. You are a comedian.
You're being a woman?
You're fucking hilarious.
Don't you dare say that to me ever
How
again.
How dare
being
you
a woman.
Be a woman, Alison? But no, what I mean is, like, I think that, well, I'm really interested in this and in exploring this with you because it's something I wanted to ask you about, the idea of comedy and stand-up and when do you become an official funny person? Like when you obviously start making money out of it, which you are very much doing mm-hmm. with your podcast. But like, I would consider you a comedian.
Oh Lord. Okay.
You wouldn't call yourself that.
I guess it's that thing of, you feel like you need to pay your dues to be a comedian. Like I haven't toured, I haven't done that stand-up.
You've toured the
circuit.
World. But, Royal Albert Hall, making people laugh.
Sure. But I feel, yeah, maybe I am just reluctant because I think it's one of those things like, the difference between calling yourself a cook and a chef. Like I've never done my time in hot kitchens and, you know, been at the pass and done 150, you know, sittings or whatever. So the comedy thing, yeah, definitely being funny is something that is hard to say because I always think that that's one of those things that's really subjective and you feel like you're not allowed to say it yourself. You have to wait for somebody else to say, oh, they're funny. There's something inherently, I don't know why with funny stuff, but there's something inherently arrogant somehow about claiming that you're funny. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I like that there's people laughing in the background as you say that.
She's hilarious. Laughter is just, yeah.
But yeah, I get that. But then you could say that sometimes I make people laugh because there's different than being like, hey, I'm hilarious.
Yeah.
I get it with anything. Like, you know, self-declarations of your own talent is awkward, but as an English person, 100-fold.
Yes.
But having seen you last Friday or a couple of Fridays ago at the Women in Music Awards, there's something about how your brain works that is so quick and so sharp. I'm so envious of it because there's people where that comes just so naturally, like those kind of, and obviously that's what you do in porno in your podcast, like the whole time. Mm-hmm. But just seeing it on the fly, because so much of what you did was on the fly and not scripted. Like, when did you, or if you ever have, kind of think, I can make people laugh?
Yeah, it's interesting you use that example of that awards thing, because actually that's sort of my favorite thing to do because it's ephemeral and nobody's going to watch that back or scrutinize it. So there's actually a freedom in that, a bit like radio, where you kind of think, there's an expectation that this is for the moment.
You can be completely reactive.
Exactly. Mm. And also with those awards, nobody's coming to that expecting it to be laugh a minute. They're like, we're gonna award some cool people and honor some great women that work in music, and the laughs are sort of a bonus. So again, that's really freeing. So I think anything that has that safety net, I think that's why I get scared of the comedian or funny person tag, because already expectations are built really high.
I see, yeah.
But the first time, I mean, I think to do the job that we do, even if you aren't I don't know, on paper an extrovert, you have to have a bit of a show off tendency and you have to like the feeling of showing off and people responding really well to that. So I think when I was a kid, I think I was definitely precocious. I think I really liked words and playing with words, and I also really liked that feeling of people thinking that you were old for your age, I guess. You know, that thing of like when you eat an olive when you're like 7 and they're like, you like olives? And you're
so sophisticated.
Wow, thanks. Yeah. It was kind of that. I sort of liked showing off and people being impressed, which sounds so gross. But I just remember that feeling good.
actually read an article about how it is so much easier for females in comedy in the US because of the amount of those comedy
institutions, I guess.
Yeah. Where you can go and learn improv. And it's so much more of a kind of opportunistic place to be as a female comedian and comedy writer.
Yeah.
Than the UK, which they're still like hugely underrepresented. Like when I read the stats, I was like, boring, same as music. It's like, yeah. It's like exactly what you would expect. All the stats are scarily like weighted towards men. You've done the panel show things. And I know there was a lot of controversy on that recently in terms of underrepresentation. And it felt like the producers were like, oh shit, better get some women. And it's like, hello. Which maybe could have thought of that before. But what, I feel like there's a kind of, this is total hypothetical spontaneous thinking, by the way, so this might not make sense. But there's a lot of parallel between the idea of a kind of the muso guy, who's like the guy in the record shop with the beard, who knows the B-side from the set in 1976.
That white label, am I right?
It's always a man. It's always a man. Mm-hmm. Similarly with the kind of the funny guy, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's kind of a default prototype for who this type of person is, which is probably why the panel shows were kind of weighted towards men, because it's just, there's just a lot more of them being like, I'll do it. Whereas I can feel like it might be an intimidating place for a woman.
I found it incredibly. I mean, I haven't done very many. I find it really intimidating, partly because what you're doing is writing jokes and I don't write jokes. Mm. And also because...
Yeah, but it should be what you're amazing at, which is witty, sharp retorts. But it's all pre-scripted.
A lot of it's scripted and a lot of it isn't collaborative. And I think I'm so much funnier with stimulus or with somebody to bounce off of. So I think when everybody's just doing their bit and they don't want to play with you, I find that really hard. When everyone's kind of just like, and then the dog ate my homework and everybody applauds and then it's your turn. I find that sort of compartmentalized way of doing it really hard. And also all those people on panel shows are comedians that have done the circuit,
and have rehearsed routines.
Yeah, and that's a skill that they've honed for 15 years and 20 years and more. So I can see why... coming into that as somebody who hasn't done any of that, you know, it kind of should be hard because it is a skill, but it's just not one that necessarily
which ones did you do?
I've done 8 out of 10 Cats many years ago. And I remember because it felt like a really big thing because I'm as discussed, I was definitely a presenter, not a comedian. And they said, oh, you can go in this new comedian seat. So that felt like a bit of a vote of confidence. And I had to audition quite a few times to do it.
Wow, I had no idea.
Yeah, I had to do two or three, I think, to get to it. One of which was a sort of just a run through in an office room with Jimmy chairing. That was the one before we did the real thing.
Okay.
And then they give you this massive pack of stuff to read up on, which I actually kind of would like delivered to my house weekly so that I can stay abreast of current affairs, to be honest, and pop culture. So it's, this dossier that you can prepare stuff on or should prepare stuff on. I just found the whole thing so blindingly intimidating that I think they kept saying to me, we'll look after you in the edit. So like, don't worry if there's something that doesn't land or something that, you know, you're not happy with, it just won't make it in because we only want the best stuff. And I was like, that makes sense. You know, why would they? We record for 3 hours. They only need whatever it is, half an hour, 45 minutes. But they can't look after you in the edit if you only say 3 things in 3 hours. I think at the beginning, I was like, they were like, analysis with us. And I was like, and like a thing fell out of my throat, but I don't know what it was. Then partway through, Jimmy said, you know, like, oh, and we're talking about this thing. You've done that right, Alice. And I was like, yes. That made it in. And then at the end, I laughed at something Carol Vorderman said, boom, you know, in the can. But I was just completely petrified.
Yeah, fair.
And also, I don't like shouting to be heard. Like, I don't have
But I think that's a unique... No, okay. I can't keep bringing it to females, but I do think that that's quite a...
Do you think that's a gender thing?
Yeah, we are happy to sit and stand back. And, like, that's... a common thing.
Well, I remember
it might be an Alice thing, but it's also Alice being a woman thing.
Sure. No, I'm sure you're right. And I remember at the time, my boyfriend at the time came and sat backstage and he was like, I was just willing you to say something. He was like, He was watching the clock and he's like, half an hour, 45 minutes, an hour. Because you're just
And then it gets too long.
Yeah.
So then if you do say something, it's too much of a big deal.
It's got to be great.
It's just like, I'm just going to not say anything for the rest.
Yeah. Unless they just thought I was... I just remember watching it back and I just had this like slightly glazed expression on my face. So maybe they just thought I was having a lovely time and enjoying what other people were saying, but oh my God.
So that was not the best first experience, but you did go back.
I've never been back on that show. I did Buzzcocks when that was on. I've done a few where it feels like they are more geared to kind of riffing rather than jokes.
Yeah.
I mean, I really liked, there's a show that I feel like should get more props because it's such a good format, which is As Yet Untitled, Alan Davis's show, which is on Dave, I believe. But it's just a really nice format. It's just four or five people sat around the table exchanging anecdotes.
Yeah.
And everybody kind of gets their moment to tell their story. So you don't feel on the clock.
Yeah.
And then everybody kind of picks
and
it apart.
It's democratic.
And has a chat. Yeah. It just feels like, you know, you have breathing space.
You're on tour and you're doing these massive venues all over the world. How do you rehearse to make those moments happen?
Well, I find that really hard because on the podcast, we don't. On the podcast, it is just all... The podcast was kind of set up in a way for us to all shine because we weren't comedians in a way. So it's set up that we record for 2 hours for a 40-minute show because we kind of have that buffer then. And none of us wanted the glory of the joke landing. We all just wanted it to be funny. There's no competition really between the three of us.
Which is such a really important place to start.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And because we're all pals and we've been friends for a really long time, I think that was just inbuilt. Mm. And so even though we didn't talk about it, the way it came to being was like, right, if we just sit around and riff, there'll be so much shit and there'll be some good stuff too. And if we've got more than double what we need, then we can just
that's genius recording for that most of time.
And the benefit of the edit, I mean, is just when you go back to live radio after doing that, you're like, ugh. Well, actually, for the new live show, this is my dad wrote a porno is the name.
So this is the new tour.
The new tour
that's starting next year, the world tour.
January.
How many dates?
How many dates? Oh gosh, I don't know. 30, 50, I actually don't know.
And it's genuinely world tour. So, and what, you've done like Sydney Opera House and stuff.
We're starting again in Sydney Opera House before it closes for 2 years.
Is this the big, this is like the biggest live podcast that's ever happened, right? Like you
would take that.
Yeah.
I don't know if I can verify that.
I don't know of any others that have ever done that.
I mean, our biggest one will be Radio City Music Hall in New York, which is, I think.
Fucking hell.
6,500 or something, which is. I mean, it's going to be amazing with just our families in it and then the rest empty. It's going to feel really special.
Honestly, though, it's mad. Did you ever think? Like, I listened to the first series over the last week or so, and just like it, you can, like, you know, you were saying at the start of the podcast about when you can hear people just like finding it themselves so fucking hilarious. Like,
yeah, I think we find it funnier than anyone. Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, when you were doing that, and it was obviously. For the joy of it, and you're still doing it for the joy of it, of course, but it's become a huge thing. Yeah. Did you ever think Radio City Music Hall?
I definitely didn't think that. When we had this idea, or when Jamie brought us the book, and we, you know, died hearing him just read us the book in the pub.
Yeah.
I think, if I'm honest, like, I thought, this is really good. Like, I knew the books were really good. Mm. And it was at a time when, I mean, of course, there were loads of podcasts, but it was 5 years ago.
It still felt new.
And it felt like an exciting time to make one. And we were even showing people on their phones what the purple button was, you know, where podcasts were and stuff.
Yeah.
So it just felt like this kind of, I don't know, this fortuitous moment. Mm. So In that sense, I was like, I really feel like we're striking on something good here. And when we told people about it, they seemed really excited about it. And I hadn't heard of anything like it. But no, I had no idea it would take off as it has. But, you know, James and JV used to tell me off because I thought it was really good. And there's not much of stuff that I have my, you know, hands on, for want of a better phrase, that I don't feel cringy about. Acknowledge, you know, like, I just find it so uncomfortable to look at stuff that I've made back and listen again and watch things again. And I used to listen to it and think it was really good. Yeah. And that's obviously a really sort of narcissistic thing to
not
admit to.
But that's not. It's just,
But also it's, you know, two people that I think are really funny as well, because I think that they're hilarious. So I remember them saying like, please, please don't listen to it on the tube. If people see you listening to your own podcast, that's mortifying. And I was like, no, but I'm listening to your bits.
Have you ever considered doing anything like writing comedy, writing a sitcom? Like, if you think about the Aisling Beers, Sharon Horgan's, the Lena Dunham, like, it feels like there's been a really exciting shift. I actually saw an interview with Julia Davis where she was talking about how fucking just exciting it is seeing these kind of autonomous women coming through, getting given shows. Surely you should be doing that. Come on.
When you mentioned, I know, when you mentioned it earlier, did I ever think about doing stand-up or doing any of those things? I think it's because I'm a bit of a coward that I've never done any of those things. So I've never done stand-up or sketch comedy or written comedy or, I mean, we write, my dad wrote porno in a sense, you know, we improvise the jokes.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think it's that thing of, I haven't failed at it yet because I haven't had a go at it yet. Mm. But I also don't really know how you go about it. I mean, I know you just put pen to paper.
That's, I mean, because Sharon Horgan did this podcast and that was one of the things I wanted to ask.
I love that episode.
Where does it begin?
Yeah.
Like, do you have a whiteboard and like make up a character? Like, how do you start writing a sitcom? Like, do you start with a character that you just really like and let them go? Like, it's, I'm just so fascinated by the process of where it fucking starts.
Yeah, because her productions just feel so... they just feel like they've always been in your life, don't they? They don't feel, you know, the characters in Catastrophe don't feel written, which is the magic and the trick. Yeah, it's a really tricky one. I was actually, I did that Travel Man show, you know, with Richard Ayoade, who is one of the funniest people. One of the, he's insanely smart, which I think is helps. Well known. yeah, definitely helps. And is really funny, but he's really dry. Mm. And, I kind of kept checking in that like everything was right because I feel like I'm such a head girl that needs, you know, constant encouragement. And he really jokingly was like, Alice, if you're looking for approbation, this is not the production for you. And I was like, no, but please, like, I know you're joking, but I actually do need it. And we started talking about films. He's a massive, massive film buff. And so we were talking about films and scripts and writing things because he obviously directs and does all of his film stuff as well as comedy stuff. And I was saying, you know, I really want to write this sitcom and we were chatting about it. And then he was like, we just need to do it. And I was like, no, I know, yeah, yeah. So then we didn't talk about it again. And then we got to the airport to fly home and we were sat on opposite window seats. So he then leaned over just before the plane took off and he said, write it, put it in a drawer, leave it for 6 weeks, come back to it, that's your first draft. Mm-hmm. Rewrite it, mm-hmm. put it in a drawer for 6 weeks. That's your second draft.
Yep.
And he was like, you know, there you go. And I was like, and before I could ask another question, he popped his headphones back in and reclined his seat and just closed his eyes. I was like, that's actually probably an incredible, incredible writing masterclass I've just been given.
There's actually a novel, well, it's more of a how-to book.
Is that In the Woods?
By Stephen King,
called
On Writing.
Yeah.
And it's basically a very basic, non-kind of snobby take on how to write a novel, mm-hmm. and that's exactly what he says. He says, write it, put it in a drawer and leave it.
Yeah.
I wrote a novel this year and I put it in a drawer and it was so fucking hard to put it in the drawer.
It was hard to put it in the drawer, not hard to write it.
It was hard not to reach for it and read it all the time. I got about a month in and then I had to take it out and read it.
And what was it like once you'd read it? Was it as you remembered? Because I bet it wasn't.
It was so different, yeah. And then I wrote the second draft based on all the stuff that I should have written the first time. But what's so helpful about the Stephen King book is that it's such a how-to. So he shows you a piece of work before an edit and after an edit, shows you all the things he's done, talks about...
Because it's really practical.
It's so practical. It's so helpful.
Yeah.
And he talked about how he starts a novel. And this made me feel so happy because I've always wanted to write a book and I've never done it because I've never had... I'm the most impulsive, impatient person. And I've never been able to take the time to sit and figure out an entire narrative.
Sure.
Like, I didn't know what the end was going to be, so how on earth should I start it?
Yeah.
But his thing was like, no, just start it. So have a scene in your head and like think there's a woman in a room. She's a nurse. She's nursing someone.
Can I write this down? Because this is good stuff. Is this and Taken?
He genuinely started with that for Misery. He started with a woman, like a nurse. Nursing
yeah, it's
person.
Taken, and, famously and, yeah, it's Taken. Yeah.
And then he just expanded and then she
Break
became-
Break knees?
Yeah, get the sledgehammer out. But yeah, it was just so like, oh fuck, okay. So you don't have to like have it all done in your head. You can just write.
Yeah, that's so freeing, isn't it?
And there's something so liberating about actually this stuff is coming out of you, this stuff that's in your head in the moment. And then you go back and read it and it's like, whoa, that just came out of me.
Yeah.
That's what just...
And you don't recognize it. Because that's actually maybe what happens when we do the improvising.
Yeah.
Like you don't kind of recognize that that has come from you when you listen back or watch back or whatever. Mm. I mean, sometimes it's because I actually have just claimed a joke that wasn't mine. I'm like, God, that was funny. And James is like, that was me. I'm like, no, I think it was me. That's really, really quite smart. I didn't even know I just knew that word. That's weird. It's funny you say Stephen King because... Rocky Flintstone.
Does he love a bit of Stephen King?
Steph King, as he calls him, is one of his faves. Oh. I wonder if he's read that.
He might have.
Yeah.
Mind you, having listened to his writing, I don't think he has.
He's not necessarily applied it effectively.
Stephen King is very against too much description.
Yeah.
He's like, you know, don't be afraid to say they said rather than they shouted really loudly.
Great description.
Just they said. He said, she said.
Yeah.
It's not a crime.
Yeah. Go, Steph.
Hey, can we talk about Julia Davis?
Yeah, go on.
So she said, well, first of all, tell me why she's amazing. For those who don't know her work.
Yeah, well, I think a few things that are brilliant if people haven't seen Human Remains, which is what she did with Rob Brydon. So fantastic. Which are just little vignettes about different couples, which is all improvised. There's an amazing thing on YouTube, actually, which is, I don't know how long it is, but it's one of their little improv sessions that you can watch that is kind of, so you can see the background before they sort of locked in on particular characters, but they're just sat on the sofa, camera in front of them, chatting it through, and it's brilliant. And obviously Nighty Night is probably the thing that people would maybe know best, which is so dark and
her
so
own
funny.
Creation.
Her own creation, she wrote it, she stars in it, and it's really twisted and really left of center and
it's
strange.
It's so dark.
It
it's
is.
Kind of very sociopathic. Like it's like incredibly dark.
Yeah.
And I wonder if in this day and age, whether she can, I mean, she recently had one, didn't she? A new one. I can't remember what it's called.
She did Sally Forever. Yeah.
Sally Forever. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But like, I feel like for her, it might be harder and harder to do in a sad way to do the comedy that she does, which is so fucking dark and twisted. And sometimes controversial.
Well, I guess the podcast Dear Joan and Jerrica
is the greatest.
Is really edgy. And maybe that's why it's a podcast. And maybe there's not opportunity on television to do that kind of long form improv like that.
Podcasts seem like the best place for women who aspire to be in comedy in terms of complete democracy.
Yeah, and I think maybe you don't have to fit into a mold. I mean, there aren't on television, there aren't that many places for comedy, full stop. Then there aren't that many places to do, you know, your own particular brand of comedy. And then maybe there aren't that many places for female comedy, you know, like we've talked about the panel show thing. I mean, there was that whole quota thing, you know, we have to have at least one woman or whatever it was, which just seems, you know, ridiculous.
It does.
But, you know, in podcasts, there kind of aren't any of those traditional requirements. So you can make what you want. It can be as long as you want. You can do it as frequently as you want. So yeah, that, I mean, that's definitely how we came to it. And I think we thought this is never a show that would be on television. I mean, partly because I actually don't think
one HBO special later.
Guilty as charged.
I love what she said about how that podcast started, which was, I think, her parents, or she suffered a bereavement in her family, and her busy mate just came over to her house and they were like, well, let's just do something that's going to make us laugh. It's like coming from the best possible authentic place.
Yeah.
Like, I need comedy. I need to feel brighter.
And you can feel that they're, I mean, we've kind of gone back to the beginning.
Dear Joan and Jerrica, by the way.
Dear Joan and Jerrica is fantastic. The first series is just the most perfect thing, isn't it? Yeah, I think that's that thing that we touched on at the beginning. You can hear what a good time they're having. I mean, you can hear the wobble in their voices, like that they're really making each other laugh. And, you know, Vicky is just hilarious. But they obviously find each other. It's that, again, that French and Saunders thing. Like, they just love being in each other's company.
Yeah.
And I think that that's why we have done as many of Rocky's books as we have. And believe me, there are many more. And I think we will quit before he quits. But, you know, we really like doing it.
Yeah.
And I think if it was a chore, or if, you know, we had a traditional broadcast commission where they were like, you have to do 12 episodes in the series, I think you would lose a bit of that magic. And don't get me wrong, sometimes I'm sure they don't want to come around to my house and sit next to my boiler and you know, read Jamie's dad's porn. They'd rather be on a date or at the cinema or doing whatever. But we always have a good time. There's never we never come out of, you know, my kitchen or whatever and aren't in a better mood, because it is just a really nice experience. So yeah, I think it feels intimate because it is intimate. You know, this is way more intimate than any radio we do, isn't it? You know,
totally.
We've got Joel hunched over having a heart attack every time somebody presses the button on the lift. Yeah. But, you know, usually, and oh my God, that
someone
motorbike.
Is just showing off.
He's going to jump out of the window now. But all of these things take huge teams of people. And this is sort of a different endeavor, isn't it?
I'm still learning, to be honest. I'm finding the whole thing. I feel a bit like when I jumped in the lake, and I feel a bit like I've got nothing to hold on to. Where's the boundaries? I don't know. What are the rules here?
Yeah.
And it's taken me now, like at the very end of this second series, to actually like relax and just tread water. I can keep this metaphor going.
Yeah, I know. I was really impressed. I was like, well, where else can she go?
Then we're going to float in the next series. But yeah, just the idea of like, there is no rules. I'm used to coming from the most regimented place, which works for that. You know, the medium of music radio is very, it is what it is. It's selling music, it's playing music, it's sharing music. But just to talk about anything for any amount of time in any way, shape or form, it's kind of overwhelmingly.
But I'm so bad at that. I mean, I know I do radio and I know I do radio where there's talking, but I find the limitlessness of that sometimes, and it's not limitless, as we know. You know, if you wang on for too long, you totally get the finger waggle in the air telling you to wrap it up. But I sometimes hear myself on Radio One, and I'm just like, shut up, shut up.
No.
What are you talking about? And actually, when we record the podcast, I sometimes say, like, for Jamie in the edit, shut up. Like, just cut this bit out. It's just shit.
Yeah.
But I have that voice in my head on radio.
Yeah.
And Dev, that I do the radio show with, he always gives that analogy, you know, which it's not Roadrunner, it's Wile E. Coyote, isn't it, that runs out. And as soon as he realizes he's just in air, he drops out of the sky.
Yeah.
I feel like as soon as I become aware, so self-aware, that I'm doing a story or doing a bit, I'm like, and then they went home for tea. Okay, here's Calvin Harris. Like, I have to just, I kind of have to roll my eyes back in my head and pretend I'm somewhere else. Because, I mean, it's like losing somebody when you're chatting to new people and you're telling them a story and people peel off because you've lost them.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like I can see people doing that in my mind. People are going and just like switching the radio off.
It's like when you're DJing and there's three people in the front row on their phones.
Soul destroying.
Just put them away.
Or, you know, like I remember Sarah Cox actually saying when I first started at Radio One, I went for a coffee with her and I didn't know her, but I just really admired her. And one of the things that she said was, you know, know what you need, like feel confident to say, oh, I need you to not be.
Sarah's good at that. She likes people, she likes eye contact.
So do I. But then I think sometimes I get too many, I get too meta and I'm like, but I've told them that I need eye contact. So they're giving me eye contact because I've told them to, but
not
I've told them to smile
to
and like, are they just smiling because they feel sorry for me because I told them that I need them to laugh at my joke, but like now they're just going to laugh. And like, now I don't really know if it's funny at all because they're going to laugh because I've asked them to, but actually what does it mean? So that's generally what is going on in my head at all times.
Yeah.
But I'm potentially an overthinker.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Confidence starts with loving who you are. And when your skin feels nourished and glows on the outside, you naturally radiate confidence from the inside. Give your skin a glow up with Osea's clinically proven Mega Moisture Duo. This ultra-hydrating body care features two of Osea's best sellers, Undaria Algae Body Oil and Undaria Collagen Body Lotion. These seaweed-powered heroes use skincare-level ingredients normally reserved for your face for results you can see and confidence you can feel. Osea has been making clean, clinically proven seaweed-infused face and body care products for over 28 years. This luxurious skincare is vegan, cruelty-free, and climate-neutral certified, so you never have to choose between your values and your best skin. Glow from the inside out. Get 10% off your first order with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code GLOW.
Dev once said to me, which has never left me, he was like, all of your stories start way too early. As in, like, I go back to, like, I was born on a sunny day in 1986. He's like, you don't need that bit. This just happened on Tuesday.
To, just go to Tuesday. The
yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. He's like, you have about, like, 6 minutes of preamble to run up to it. Yeah. And that's so true.
Yeah.
And also, I kind of know what that is. That's sort of me finding my feet.
Mm.
But as soon as he said that, you know, now...
Are you super conscious of it?
Of course, yeah. I mean, it's been kind of life-altering, but I think I used to be really self-conscious about telling the same story more than once as well, which you kind of can't be in radio because you just never have...
You just bank it for the next time it feels right.
Otherwise, you'd be having to, like, jump out of an aeroplane twice a day to have stories. I mean,
it's like when Grimmy used to do the breakfast show, and every time I hung out with him, I just felt like, oh, this is an anecdote. I know I'm going to hear this next Wednesday at 7:55. And there it is. It's like life becomes churned out through radio links.
Yeah, I
because
guess
you have to have it's stuff inevitable. To talk about.
Yeah, totally. And also, I think you have to see. I mean, you have to see something extraordinary in the ordinary, and sometimes it is just ordinary. Mm. So sometimes you're like, okay, I think there's something funny in this, and you start telling it, and you're like, no, it was just a post office queue, but it's kind of too late now.
Yeah, but it takes a lot to make that funny.
And not always funny. Sometimes just a post office queue. Sometimes you're just going, it's in a post office queue today. What do you think, guys? 8-1-9-9? Have you done that? Have you ever been in a queue? Today we're talking about queues.
Text in now.
And often they don't. Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about moving forward. So my dad wrote Porn is not going anywhere apart from fucking Radio City Music Hall.
Yeah, so mainly away next year doing live things. I'm not sure when does this go out?
Next week.
We like to call it. Oh gosh, you're very reactive.
Yeah.
So we're just coming to the end of our fifth series. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure Rocky will have something.
Only five.
I know it's dragged, hasn't it? Yeah.
No, really has. It feels like because it just feels like so you do one series a year.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
How many apps?
Our work ethic is appalling. It depends how many chapters are in his novel.
Yeah.
I hate to call it a novel. usually between like 12 and 14 is kind of. Yeah. How many he does.
That's a lot,
And then we have guests in between. So, yeah, about 20-something episodes a series, yeah.
Wow. Okay, that's loads, yeah. Okay, so that all next year.
That all next year.
And then when are we going to see this sitcom? When's it going to get in the
drawer? So I need to write it, put in a drawer six weeks.
Yeah.
Get it out, put it in a drawer.
Surely you'll have
weeks,
loads of time on aeroplanes. Get cracking.
Oh, man, but I don't divvy my time the way you do. Like on an aeroplane, I need at least an hour staring into space.
Wow. I'm in awe of that.
I mean, not literally.
I have to schedule that in. I'm joking, of course.
No, you're not. Do you watch films on planes? No, you do.
Yeah,
stuff.
And I weep. I love it. It's like I love watching films on planes because I don't really get to do it.
It's very
life.
Cathartic. Crying bit.
No, you're right. You're right. It is definitely good just to chill out on planes. Definitely.
I mean, they're long planes though.
Yeah.
I mean, it's 24 hours to Australia. I mean, within that, I've got even if I stared into space for four hours, I've got a lot spare.
Yeah.
No, you're right. I totally should. And I should do the Stephen King. I should just do the nurse in a room bit first.
Yeah.
I'm not actually going to do the nurse in a room.
I know what you're like. I bet you have ideas already and you have people and things that you want to get out of your head.
But sometimes I really feel like all I have in my head is what I can see. So sometimes I'm like...
Yeah, but that's what everyone says. Just write what you see.
Radio presenter.
Listen, I am happy to be... To
will you be my muse? Oh,
that's what I loved about Sharon Horgan because she was like, obviously I... like put myself forward to star in my own sitcom because no one else was going to.
Yeah.
And I think there has to be kind of a real ballsy, for want of a better word, titsy, I don't know, like yeah. gusto, if you're going to do this and be like, okay, no one's going to pluck me out of the wilderness and be like, you should write a sitcom.
Yeah.
It's, you have to do it and put it in front of people's faces and be like, and by the way, I can act, so.
And that was what the podcast was, I think.
Yeah.
I was definitely, you know, I remember saying to Jamie, can I, when he first read it to us, can I have this and go and do a one woman show with it? And he was like, yeah, do what you want. And then we all kind of decided that that was, completely self-interested, and it would make way more sense if he was reading his dad's porn. But you know, initially, it was just, it was a vehicle for us to be funny.
Yeah, yeah.
So yeah, you're totally right. And it's kind of, when I was listening to the Sharon episode, I thought, yeah, that's that same thing where you have to create something, a space, whatever it is, a vehicle that lets you do the things you want to do. Because I think for so long, I just got offered presenting gigs where I was just stood next to a guy laughing at what he said. Basically for like the first 5 years of being a presenter, I felt like that was all the jobs. Or just kind of reading other people's words. And I didn't really want to do that. I mean, like all of that is good, I think good practice and is good grounding. But you get to a point where you think like, I want to do the jokes and I kind of want to write the jokes. And also
maybe I want to direct the jokes.
Yeah.
As Sharon said, there's not a lot of money in it, but if you want it, you could.
If you've got the inclination, sure. Yeah, but I don't know if you find it with music projects, but so often they don't, you know, the things that I get offered don't satisfy all the things that I want to do. So it kind of is easier to be a control freak and come up with all the things, you know, come up with a concept or have a hand in lots of the different parts.
Also, I think it's easy for people to have perceptions of you and who you are. And I think if you'd always worked in comedy and always worked in stand-up comedy, then it would feel easier for people. But because you do music radio, people are like, well, maybe she wants to be a presenter. It's hard. Like, I find that people put me in the music box all the time and don't really think of me as anything beyond that.
Yeah.
But I'm like, I'd love to talk about other things.
Yeah, totally.
And do other things and write and do all that stuff. So sometimes you have to help people to see that you can be.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, when I see people who are comedians, funny women, talking about what they do, I always think, oh, but you're like intrinsically funny. Like when you hear Vicky Pepperdine talk, she's just a funny person, or Natasha Dimitriou, or, you know, whoever it is, you're like, you've got funny bones. So I sometimes think labeling yourself as funny, there's this like pressure where you feel like, oh no, people are going to expect everything you say to be a gag. And yeah, I do.
Yeah, but everything you say is a gag. You don't even know it.
That one didn't land. Cheers, guys.
Okay, but you, like, honestly, every time I see you or speak to you, it's in you. I don't think you realize it. You're one of those people. You're a funny person. Man. Fucking deal with it, Alice. Oh, you're funny.
Fuck off, Annie.
Okay, we'll do this time next year.
I think we say this time next week. I was like, it has actually been quite, it's good for my ego.
I want you to do, I want you by this time next year to deliver a draft too. Okay?
Okay.
There's plenty of time.
Great, thanks.
If I can write a novel in a year, you this can is fucking the kind write a sitcom,
of, this
okay?
This is the kind of thing that definitely triggers anxiety dreams. I'm going to be like, Max said I had to write a sitcom by now. And it's also the kind of thing that you will forget you said to me, but I will think about for the next year. Honestly, I wouldn't expect if my eyebrows are falling out by next week. Really stressful, thank you.
Just do it.
I hate long deadlines.
Richard said it. Well, then don't do a long deadline. Just do it. Start it this week. Oh my God, I've become a real bully. I'm so sorry. I've invited you in here and now I'm just...
I'm doing you a favor.
I'm shouting at you, telling you to write a sitcom.
And it was like soft touch and now it's really tough love. Damn. Does each episode end with a sort of...
a declaration. Exactly. Hey, thank you so much.
Annie.
I promise I won't shout at you next time.
Always a pleasure. This is the longest I've seen you sit in one place at one time.
Scheduled. Thank you, Alice Levine. Oh my God, I'm such a bossy boots. Jesus, normally I only get like that when I'm drunk and I didn't even have a drink. So apologies to Alice Levine there. I hope her eyebrows don't really fall out or whatever she said. And maybe we will have to do it in a year to see if she actually did write that sitcom. So that is it. for this week and nearly for this entire series. Remember, if you have anything you want to say, the email address is findingannymack@gmail.com. Anything you want to say about comedy, about women in comedy, about anything that me and Alice spoke about tonight, it would be very welcome, and I'd love to hear your views. So we're ending the series with a bang, a very fun and loud bang in the shape of a conversation with Rylan Clark Neal. You will probably know Rylan as the guy that started out on The X Factor, who later won Celebrity Big Brother 11, and has now kind of gone from being the butt of the joke to the guy who is most definitely laughing from a wonderful place in his career. He's got a mainstream primetime show on Radio 2, the biggest radio station in the country. He is hosting some of the biggest shows on the television, and he is just a very, very inspiring man with a lot of depth. And I want to talk to him about loads of things next week. I'm really excited to talk to him about his past and how he's kind of turned the perception of him around and what he's had to go through personally and mentally in his career, those kind of battles and grapples with his own self-worth to get to the point where he is today. So I'm hoping it will be a very inspiring and probably hilarious, because it's Rylan, conversation, and I can't wait for you to hear it. See you then.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.